On January 15, 1998, during the annual conference of the Association of Christian Continuing Education Schools and Seminaries, known as ACCESS, which met on the campus of the U.S. Center for World Mission, Dr. Ralph Winter spoke on the theme, "The Largest Stumbling Block to Leadership Development in the Global Church." Following Dr. Winter's presentation is a question and answer session, with the questions summarized, followed by the presentation to Dr. Winter of ACCESS's first Lifetime Achievement Award, in recognition of his contributions to distance learning. Dr. Winter is introduced by Dr. Bob Freeman, Associate Provost for Continuing and Distance Education at Fuller Theological Seminary in Pasadena, California.
I knew I was called to go to seminary, and so I started going to Gordon-Conwell, and I assumed that that meant I was supposed to be a pastor. And it wasn't long after I got there that I realized that wasn't the case. Just my personality wasn't cut out for that. So, well, the next assumption must be to be a missionary, right? So I started preparing at Gordon-Conwell with my wife to go to the mission field. And we started, particularly myself, being interested in a field called theological education by extension. And reading books by people like Wagner, who I'd never heard of before, and Kinsler, and some guy named Winter. At that point, I'd been in seminary about 2.5 years, and I said, this stuff is right. Compared to my experience, this is what's needed. And so I started bugging Gordon-Conwell in a little way to try to implement that stuff. And they said, well, go ahead and try. One thing led to another. I started working half-time and three-quarter-time, and before I knew it, I had a job at Gordon-Conwell trying to implement some of the ideas of the theological education by extension movement. The Lord is sovereign, and not only did he use the writings of Ralph Winter to make that possible, but he used an economic leverage, which all of us know about. It's helpful when enrollments on campus decline because it helps the non-traditional increase. After I sold it to Gordon-Conwell, I started coming more regularly to these ACCESS meetings, and lo and behold, who should show up at one in Fort Lauderdale but this guy named Ralph Winter. And I was in awe because he was one of my heroes. And I can still remember sitting out on a deck of this hotel in Fort Lauderdale, freezing to death because we wanted to soak up the rays, but it was blowing a lot. And Ralph and Roberta and my wife Carrie and I sat there and had lunch and visited for, I think, 2 or 3 hours. They were talking to us about raising kids because we had 4 little kids at the time, and they were quoting things about health and psychology, and I'm going, man, how does this guy know all this stuff? Then, a little later on, Ralph came to Gordon-Conwell to try to sell me on selling Gordon-Conwell on a new curriculum for seminaries. He wasn't satisfied with changing the delivery mechanism of what we did. He wanted to redo the whole way seminary education was taught. Instead of dividing it into specialized subjects, he wanted to reintegrate it. And I said, Ralph, I value my job. I'm making good progress on the delivery mechanism, but you know, let's not try to change the whole thing right away. And now, here I am at Fuller Seminary as assistant professor of continuing and distance education in the School of World Mission, where Peter Wagner is one of my colleagues, and Ralph Winter is right up the street. I teach a course called Adult Training in the Infotech Age, and Ralph actually came this past fall to talk to our students. And they had the classic reaction to Ralph Winter. He was there for the evening and visited with us. And we learned about dust mites and all kinds of other things, which I can't even remember at the moment. And when he left, they said, wow, we have never met a guy who knows more about more subjects than Ralph Winter. And they were very impressed. Okay, formally, Ralph graduated from Caltech with a degree in engineering. Then he got an MA in teaching English as a second language at Columbia University. and then a PhD at Cornell in linguistics, cultural anthropology, and mathematical statistics. Quite a combination. Then he graduated from Princeton Seminary and was ordained in the PCUSA. From 56 to 66, Ralph and Roberta served in Guatemala as missionaries to the Native American tribal group of Mayan family peoples. They assisted the national church in a variety of ways, including education, small business development, and a special kind of theological education by extension. On the basis of that, and many other things, Ralph was invited to join Fuller School of World Mission in its second year. And here's a real winterism. It says, during the next 10 years, the Winters dealt with over 1,000 missionaries in and out of class, learning a great deal about the global cause of Christ. I think Ralph is a great illustration of a lifelong learner who treats his students as research associates. Ralph then founded the William Carey Library, a specialized publisher and distributor of mission materials, founded the American Society of Missiology, and assisted in founding ACMC, Advancing Churches in Mission Commitment. And he inaugurated the Perspective Studies Program. Over the years teaching at Fuller we like to think of ourselves as one of the most innovative seminaries, but it wasn't innovative enough for Ralph, so he had to leave. It became more and more clear, and here's another winterism, that somebody would have to do something special. And again, that's the way I see Ralph, as he's always feeling that somebody has to do something special, and he often volunteers to do that, to recall the mission movement to a frontier focus. So the Frontier Mission Fellowship was born in 1976 for that purpose, immediately initiating two major projects in which we sit, partly the U.S. Center for World Mission and the William Carey International University. In the next 20 years, a community of workers composing the Frontier Mission Fellowship was developed, ready and willing to tackle any problem impeding the mission movement. Winter served as CEO of the center until 1990, and of the university until 1997. And this would be a good opportunity for me, on behalf of all of us who are participating, to thank you, all of you from the center and the William Carey University, for hosting us and the great job that you've done in putting together all the details of this. We really appreciate that. Dr. Winter is Vice President of the Southwest Region of Evangelical Mission Society, as well as being active in the International Society Frontier Missions, which he helped to initiate. So, I just have one announcement to make before we ask Ralph to come up here. The title of his talk is "The Largest Stumbling Block to Leadership Development in the Global Church." And the announcement is, those of us from seminaries with thin skins, we might consider leaving now. Dr. Winter, thanks for being here.
I'm not going to act like George Brewer and sell you a lot of books, but I just thought I would show you some books that I do not have for sale, but they're good to know about. This book is in a second printing already, called The Scapegoat Generation, America's War on Adolescence. If you want a book that will really shake you up because it contradicts almost all normal understanding of what's actually happening at the adolescent level in our country, and that, of course, relates directly and indirectly to the school system and to the whole structure of the society. Another book that's a fairly recent book is called Theological Education in the Evangelical Tradition. And I think it's the first book that I know of since H. Richard Niebuhr's book, The Ministry in Historical Perspective, which is a superb book, that tries to evaluate what's going on, and in this case, specifically the evangelical tradition. In the case of the earlier book by Niebuhr, there's only one chapter, really, on the American experience. But that is really a stunning chapter. I remember when I first read that chapter, I thought, what does he mean, the American concept of a minister? What's so different about the American concept of a minister? Well, read on. It's a very different concept from other parts of the world. Anyway, this is a recent book which has been reviewed in this current issue of Christianity Today on page 50 under the title, Why Evangelicals Have the Biggest Seminaries and Why They Are in Crisis. Now, I don't think this article took into account the potential loss of Korean students due to the Asian financial crisis. But this financial pressure that Bob referred to, that's been what Andrew Walls would refer to as a fortunate subversion of the status quo, forcing schools to say, how can we get students that can't come to campus in order to keep our budget up to snuff? This is another major factor which will add to this crisis. Then there's a third book, which I have to mention, called Being There. This is the analysis over a four-year period of about four or five people of the culture and the formation going on in two major theological seminaries. One, an evangelical seminary, which is not named, but Bob Freeman will recognize it. It's a very intimate glimpse of a rather candid outsider's view of what's actually happening at Gordon-Conwell and at some other unnamed mainstream, what they call a mainstream seminary. Now, this also has a review that goes with it, which was kindly given to me. The review is written by a woman professor at Princeton Seminary. So apparently, Princeton is not the mainstream seminary that this book talks about. And most of the review speaks in awed tones of what's wrong with the mainstream seminary and paints it as a place where there's a lot of bickering over trivialities and all kinds of superficial issues and camps and that they call affinity groups hunkered down in the trenches. And whereas the evangelical seminary, while the people were a little bit wide-eyed at some of the cultural peculiarities of evangelicals, nevertheless, they were very favorably impressed. And so that's an interesting book, too. So this is just for the grist for the mill, these things. I'm a little embarrassed at this topic. I actually helped word it, but I realize now how pompous a subject it is and how presumptuous it is. And I feel quite embarrassed, really, to tackle it. And I hope you don't feel that it's more than just an attention getter here. There may be other problems besides the one that I refer to. However, I will say that from my own point of view, this is the major stumbling block in leadership development in the global church. And I'm not going to let you wonder what that stumbling block really is until the very end of the talk. I'll just give it to you straightforward. I refer very simply to the far-reaching practice of selecting the wrong people for training. It's that simple. Now I'm through. Okay? This is the largest stumbling block in leadership development in the global church. First of all, why would we, and I include myself in this movement of theological education, why would we do such a thing? Why would we, all over the world, put enormous sums of money and manpower into training the wrong people? In fact, that's why it takes a little further comment, because just to state that seems baldly and hopelessly erroneous. How could it possibly be true? Now, I ask, why would we do such a thing, especially because this is not an academic question, to use the depraved meaning of that word. Because when you train the wrong people, you bypass the right people. You, in effect, suppress the training of the right people if what you're doing is training the wrong people. In other words, the more gifted leaders of the Christian movement are not being recruited into ministry in much of the world church. The whole future of our form of Christianity, now, I'm not speaking merely of the evangelical tradition. I might as well be honest with you. When I say our form of Christianity, I refer to practically anything and everything that is called Christian. Because, as a matter of fact, the Christian movement is much larger than those who call themselves Christians. And for the most part this evening, I'm not referring to this larger part, but at least in my first dimension, or if you want, I hesitate to call it a point, I would like to take a quick look at the reality of the world movement of followers of Christ, because it isn't what most people think it is. And each one of these little subpoints here would take half an hour to elucidate in detail, but let's go to Africa. In Africa, the majority of those who follow Christ, who read the Bible earnestly, who seek the living God, and who, for whom the Bible is the most prominent feature of their movement, the majority of those people are not what we would call normally Christians. They're part of what is loosely described, a very, very wide spectrum category called, most recently, it was originally the African Independent Churches, then the African Indigenous Churches, and now more recently I hear it's the African Initiated Churches. We're struggling to get respectable terminology for a movement that we've for a long time considered quite unrespectable. But there are about 32 million people in this movement. And when the great Jikoi meeting took place in Pretoria, South Africa, with more countries represented than at any earlier Christian meeting in human history, they weren't even invited. Why weren't they invited? Because everybody knew they wouldn't come. Most of their leaders are illiterate. So you don't invite illiterate people to respectable Christian meetings, you know? These people are so far off the beaten track. While they are referred to as churches, most of them don't even use the word Christian. And so, like I say, we don't really, most of us probably will never have anything to do with that dimension of the Christian movement. I wish it were not true. At that meeting at Pretoria in July, the first evening, they presented a 96-year-old man who looked like he was in pretty good shape. He was, you know, 70 years earlier, I don't want to exaggerate, a young missionary going out to Africa from the Assemblies of God. He got wind of what he considered the Holy Spirit's work beyond the normal, respectable church. And he began to work with that. And he was so earnest that he didn't even insist that they form Assemblies of God churches. So, to make a long story short, they threw him out of the board. They said, we're not going to support a missionary who's going to produce Assemblies of God churches. What in the world do you think you're working for? The kingdom? You know, that kind of thing. And then Dr. McGavran heard about this, and he prevailed on the people at Springfield to take him back in, and he was back in for a while, and then I guess he got out again. Anyway, here he is, after 70 years of ministry in Africa, and he's the only foreign missionary that I know of who's taken seriously what is now a 32 million sized movement. I mean, there isn't anything that we've ever said in an access meeting that would have anything useful to say to this movement. I mean, most of our education employs the printed page, doesn't it? These people can't read. What do you do about that? Now, Eddie talked about that this morning earlier. There are ways to deal with that, but we're not really very high on that sort of thing. Well, now, let me hasten on. I can't give that much time to all these different churches. If you go to Latin America, again, 7 out of 8 new churches in Brazil, and there are about 10 or 15 a week, maybe someone said 50, who knows it, almost all of them are Pentecostal. They don't have seminaries. They don't believe in seminaries. And that isn't quite true. They've now finally got a seminary in the States and are inheriting all the problems that that's going to create. But in any event, Latin America is a very rapidly growing sphere of world Christianity, but it's not growing properly, respectably, normally. It's growing out of control. It isn't coming to our feet for training. It isn't coming to our institutions. It's people don't have time for that. The institutions aren't interested in reaching out. I'll just a little digression here. I was asked to go back to Brazil 10 years after being there the first time preaching the gospel of TEE, and they formed an association for theological education by extension right on the spot. I didn't propose that they do that. They just did it, and I was very pleased to see that happen. 10 years later, they said, come back and see what we've done. So I went back, and they had 100 specialized textbooks developed in Portuguese for that burgeoning extension movement. And then 20 years later, this is 1965, 1975, 1985, I was asked to come down after 20 years. And again, you know, every 10 years, just drop in, you know. And here I was for the first couple of days, quite in the dark. I found out at a luncheon meeting that they had changed the name of the association. They dropped the word extension out. I talked to several of the people there. It was now just an association of theological schools. Most of the people there didn't really know much about extension. They wouldn't have ever come to an access meeting. And so I shifted gears. So in the last 2 days of the conference, I preached the gospel of extension, and I think I, like it says in the book of Acts, and some believed. But the movement is out of control. The standard schools have nothing to do with it. Let's go to India. In India, this is a more recent revelation as far as my own knowledge and experience is concerned. There are apparently more people seriously reading the Bible and following Jesus Christ in India than all of those who call themselves Christians or who are even called Christians by anybody. I can't prove this. I don't think I would stake my life on that statement, but even if it's pretty far wrong, there's an enormous phenomenon which we are not only not taking into account, but probably could not take into account meaningfully using the tools we have, the techniques we have, and so forth. Or go to China. Here's the largest movement in human history that has grown as fast as it has. Out of practically nothing, in 35 years, to 50, 60, 80, 100 million people. Again, I won't stake my life on any of those numbers, but it is an enormous phenomenon. Now, we think of these as house churches, you know, and of course, there's thousands now of regular churches. The Chinese government slightly underestimated the reality when they opened 100 churches, which they thought would satisfy all the, you know, the whimpering and stuff and make the foreign diplomats happy. And those 100 churches were instantly jammed. Well, they said, well, we'll open another 100. Pretty soon they had 1,000, and then 5,000. And, you know, there is just standing room only in these churches. Those are the straight churches. But I'm talking about the 50,000 other churches. What are they really like? I don't think we would want to know in many cases. We would be awed and aghast. I mean, they are the category of the Africa-initiated churches, the 32 million in Africa, quite possibly. Now, let me warn you. In Africa, at one point, someone figured out that about one-third of all these denominations, this was way back 25 years ago, they figured there are 6,000 different denominations of these strange people. One-third of these denominations had a divine person in the membership, and they're called messianic for that reason. That's a strange use of the word, but nevertheless, you have wild heresy in many of these churches. And guess what? The cutting edge of Christianity for the last 2,000 years has been heresy from the beginning to the end. I mean, there's no other version of fast-growing Christianity out beyond the bounds of the settled ranks that isn't very obviously, in many ways, heretical. But I remember McGavin used to say, look, it doesn't matter what these people believe. And, you know, all the missionaries in the class are practically shocked and fall over dead. And then he says, look, the main thing is, are they reading the Bible? If they keep on reading the Bible, they'll turn out okay. And then to clinch the logic of that statement, he goes on to say, for example, the Jehovah's Witnesses read the Bible.
You can bet on them. In the long run, they'll find their way into the traditional churches. The Mormons don't read the Bible. There's no hope for them. Now, that brief comment of McGavin shouldn't be taken as his full wisdom on those two movements, but in any event, it doesn't really matter, according to McGavin, what they believe if they're pursuing the living God in the pages of his word. And it's up to us to get that word into their hands. Now, in India, that isn't a problem. You've got a lot of very highly literate, highly educated, very wealthy people in India who can buy anything that's in the bookstore. So that's not a problem. In Africa, it's quite different. Most of the leaders of this 32 million block aren't literate. You say, well, no wonder they're a heresy. Well, that's not the reason they're heretical. They know a lot about the Bible. One of the larger of these groups, the Kimbangu movement, for example, started by Simon Kimbangu, they put him in jail, the Belgians. And this was the Belgian Congo back then. For 38 years, he sweltered in prison. And he actually died one year before independence came. And some of the jailers said, oh, what a shame that the old man didn't get out. He was such a tremendous influence in the jail. A lot of the prisoners fell under his sway. And the jailers were friendly to him, and they said, oh, if he had just lived to this day of independence, he might have been able to rebuild his movement. Within a year, there were over 1 million followers. There only had been 100,000 when he went to prison. And shortly after that, it was 2 or 3 million, and they're all over in the middle of Africa. And they didn't know about the Lord's Supper, so they couldn't become members of the World Council of Churches. So they went back to the Bible, read about it, said, sure, why not? So now they're members of the World Council of Churches. It isn't that these people are heretical because they're rebelling against God. It's because, here's the key word, access was not there. Well, anyway, so you've got a very large proportion of the Earth's surface covered. Well, let's come to the United States. Again, I have to quote Wagner. The last 25,000 new churches in this country, most of them are devoid of seminary-trained leaders. Maybe 5% have seminary-trained leaders. Now, I'm not saying this is a good thing at all. I'm just describing what is true. But now, when you come to the United States, there's a different dynamic to some extent. It's not that the people don't have the money to go to school, or that they don't live near enough to go to school, or they can't leave their families to go to school, or they can't leave their jobs to go to school. In this country, that's much more nearly the case. But even so, in this country, the rapidly growing edge of the Christian movement, and the same thing is true in England, with 5,000 new churches over there, there's practically no connection between these new churches and the standard traditional orthodox theological training which we all rightly value so highly. And the reason is access. Even in this country. I remember in Costa Rica, the year I was there studying Spanish, way back in 56, there was a man there who was a CPA, very bright, earnest, lay believer. He wanted to go to seminary. He lived right next door to the seminary, one of the best in Latin America. I said, hey, you don't have any problem. He says, well, you know, I have to work during the day, and they only teach during the day. So he couldn't go to seminary. Now, here's the problem. We are not training the right people, not just because the right people don't want to study, but many times we're not making accessible what we have. My own personal pilgrimage, you might call it, has put me into contact with a lot of evidence for this. When I first got to Guatemala, I had no idea of what I'm talking about. A friend of mine from seminary days had been there for 5 years, Jim Embry. He's here tonight. He had already figured out that the key leaders that the church really depended upon weren't able to go off to the capital for years to seminary and then come back to their families and their jobs. They couldn't do it. And I figured out myself one time, years later, that if you wanted to finance all those real local leaders into proper theological seminary training, it would run about $15 billion per year. You say there must be a lot of these guys. That's right. There are about 2 million functional pastors who can't be ordained or who are barely ordained or mostly not ordained simply because they cannot digest the mechanism of theological education that would theoretically be available to them. Billy Graham, you know, brought 1983, 10,000 to Amsterdam. He thought he was bringing all the itinerant evangelists of the world. Actually, not one out of 10 was an itinerant evangelist in the specialized sense. These were all itinerant evangelists in the ordinary pastoral sense. In Guatemala, every single church was in the business of starting new churches. Average would be three. One church I know in, down the hill had 25 new churches going at one point. Now, when Billy Graham brought them all to Amsterdam, he thought, man, that's going to be a great blessing to all these, you know, kind of ordinary pastors of the world. I thought to myself, 10,000, that's a teaspoonful of them. So then in 1986, he brought another group. I was actually at that meeting. It was a wonderful meeting. Met all these guys, about 250 from Guatemala. I knew many of them myself. And again, he thought, well, now I've done my job. I've gotten all these people. I didn't talk to Billy in these terms, but I could have said, well, Billy, if you really want those people to come, you have to expand your attendance from 10,000 to 2 million. That's how many functional pastors there are who are literally functioning as pastors but do not have a scrap of formal theological education. Access is the problem. The problem of access. So when I was in Guatemala then for 10 years, Jim and I worked together very closely and developed what was later referred to as the Presbyterian experiment in theological education by extension. And I edited a book of some 600 pages, which you can look at if you can find a copy. I can't even find my own copy. It's been out of print for quite a while. It'll tell you the story of that growth. And it's a very interesting thing. It's a fascinating thing, because we ran into political problems within the church. Some pastors thought they looked at all these new people coming in who were being recruited, and they would then go to the Presbyterian meetings, and many of these people were business people or lawyers or attorneys, and these existing pastors, one of them told me, I'll never forget, sitting in a restaurant one night in the capital city, he said, "Los misioneros están tratando de desterrorizar a los pastores." Those missionaries are out to dethrone the pastors. And he ended up running a bookstore. There were more gifted people in the church than he was. He'd gotten into seminary as a young person, needing something to eat, wanting something to learn, and he became a pastor, a faithful person. But he was better at running a bookstore than a church. And the man who took his place came right out of lay work as an adult, and was trained in the seminary by an extension method. And it wasn't very long before the number of people that were made accessible to theological education were able to outvote all the existing pastors. But if that had not been true, our experiment would have been voted out of business. You can be sure of that. There's a great deal of resistance to change along this line, not just resistant from existing pastors who did it that way. I mean, I was thinking the other day, how in the world are professors going to effectively use the internet when they never studied by the internet in the first place, you know?
This concludes side one. Please fast forward the tape to the end and turn it over for the continuation of this program on side two.
We're starting really, we have to pull ourselves up by our bootstraps in those areas, because we don't have any experience. Most of our seminaries don't have anybody who got their theological degree in an extension mode. Count on your fingers. I don't think you need any fingers at all to talk about professors in mainstream evangelical seminaries who got their degree. In fact, when I was at Fuller, inadvertently, One of the students in Seattle, which was one of their extension sites, I often went up there to teach myself. Nobody but a kosher Fuller professor went there, all the same books, textbooks, everything you couldn't possibly say that it was deficient. But when a person up there inadvertently to the administration took all the courses you needed to take in order to get an MA degree in theology and then asked for the degree, there was great consternation back home. And I was in the faculty senate at the time, and just eight people, two from each of the three schools and the registrar and the president. And the registrar was saying, this is ridiculous. We can't give degrees to people who study someplace else. And some of you remember the great New Testament expositor, George Eldon Ladd. He was one of the two representatives from the School of Theology. I remember him pounding the table. He says, no one will ever get a degree who doesn't come and study here in Pasadena on this campus. And he would exclude even the people who would come right to the campus in the evening to study, because they weren't the proper kind of people. They were older people. They were more intelligent. They were more stable Christians. I mean, you can't expect those people to be ministers. You don't want them to get a degree. You've got to keep them out of ordination. Well, I remember, not to put Fuller down, I was at Gordon Conwell one time. This was before the Akin Gay Institute, which Bob Freeman ran. I had, for years, been in touch with Harold Akin Gay, and while I wasn't one of his best friends, he was one of the most respected people in my life, and I had many times, from the time I was a teenager even, would write him a letter. I'd send him a postcard addressed to me, and he'd give me an answer, and I really appreciated that. So we sat in the refectory, you know, that's the good old Catholic name for the mess hall, and we sat across the table, and he said, no, Ralph, he says, tell me what you mean by extension theological education. What would it look like if we were to go that route? So you can imagine the acceleration that flowed through my veins at that point. I said, look, over the years, Gordon Conwell has pumped powerfully wonderful evangelical people into the veins of the Presbyterian USA denomination. I don't know what the percentage of the students there at Gordon Conwell were. In those days, it was about two-thirds were going into that one denomination. And he said, over a period of time, you're going to have an influence on the whole denomination, hopefully. But notice how slowly that's going to be. Suppose you put out 100 new ministers into 18,000 each year. After 10 years, you put in 1,000 out of 18,000. But I said, look, from my experience back in Guatemala, the real leaders, the gifted people that God could readily utilize in a pastoral capacity, are right there in those churches. You go to the 12,000 congregations, you'll find at least an average of three people in each of those congregations who, with the proper theological training, could be ordained and could do a better job than the person who's in the pulpit. And I said, stop and think. Within 4 or 5 years, you could flood the denomination with your people. There would be no way to stop this influence. You could enroll in 1 year 10,000 students to start with. Well, good old Akin Gay, brilliant, competent, faithful servant that he was, he could not digest that. But, you know, he was really old. I think he was probably 73 years old, which is my age. A similar event took place at my older brother's home down here in Pasadena. He was very close to David Hubbard and to some of the others in the development dimension at Fuller, and he invited Dave Hubbard and me and four or five others down to the house one evening shortly after I came to Fuller in the School of World Mission from Guatemala, and David Hubbard, now this is years later, no, this is actually years earlier, excuse me, David Hubbard asked the same question. I mean, after all the talk about principles and stuff, what would Fuller look like if we were to go that route? And probably I wasn't as cautious and careful and thoughtful and wise as I tried to be when I talked to Akingay. I was a little bit more careless. I said, well, Dave, wouldn't be any problem to explain this. First of all, you'd shut the campus down and you would establish maybe 28 extension centers here and enroll probably 4,000 people and so on. I couldn't even get into the second paragraph. What difference does it make if it's possible? It's not interesting. It's not the right route we're going. Well, they did. When Robert Munger came on the faculty 2 or 3 years later, he also had similar interests. He was very much a man of the church, and he was very eager for the seminary to make a contribution to the church. And he, probably more than any other person, certainly not I, helped Fuller into an extension mode. But after 10 years in that mode, they still would not give a degree to somebody who studied in Seattle. And there was no reason they couldn't, except, and this is a pervasive problem in human society, when the means to an end becomes the end, you're in big trouble. Now, all of us here represent means, schools. Schools that are set up to provide a certain service. And if you read in Princeton Seminary's catalog there, it says, we exist to serve the church. Now, I think that's an honest statement, but it's not accurate. Princeton Seminary has other goals that they have to deal with. Intermediate goals, sure, but intermediate goals are the worst enemy of the real goals if you can't see beyond those intermediate goals. They have the intermediate goal of paying all those professors. See? That means they have the intermediate goal of getting enough money in, not only in tuition, but in donations. They've got a lot of things to do to keep alive and to keep going and to keep their building program in mind and their Spear Library and all that stuff. You know, they've got, without thinking about the church, now they probably do think about the church, but this book, which highlights one of the mainstream seminaries, gives you one of the most dismal views you can imagine. I just blanched the thought. I can't imagine Christian Century even publishing this review of what actually goes on in schools for whom apparently the means has become the end. The real end is out of sight. I remember years ago, after I got to Guatemala and after Jim and I worked on this program, we sold the idea to other missions in Guatemala, then to other countries, and there was an association of theological schools that was formed in the northern region, which means 17 out of 21 Latin American countries were in this association called ALET. I was the second executive director of that association. Our thoughts about extension got right into the structure of that association, not like the ATS. That took me all over the place to different countries. In those days, there was very little resistance in the mission field to ideas that would nourish the church. I think missionaries, most of whom do not spend their full time in schools, are very much more alive to the possibilities of theological extension. That's why this theme, this time here, of access is so important, that we're talking about the global reality now. It may shake us just a little, because all these reviews, all these books are slavishly confined to the USA. In any case, going around to these different countries, visiting these different schools, a great deal boomed into action. And then eventually going around the world, under the sponsorship of the EFMA. Wagner went around the world with Ralph Koval, and Koval and I went around the next year, and sowing the seeds of TEE. And then Wayne Weld, now a professor at North Park Seminary in Chicago, did his doctoral dissertation on the development of the movement, and he produced the World Directory of TEE, and there were 100,000 people studying for the ministry the time that book was produced, under, you know, maybe 400 or 500 different schools around the world. But then, while that movement, to some extent, is still there, I've often referred to it as collapsing. What this society could do about that collapse, I'm not sure. Actually, what it will do, I mean, I'm sure what it could do. But the major stumbling block which withdrew those schools from helping people into the ministry by extension was the fact that this pattern was not being followed in the United States. And to a great extent, what's done in this country tyrannizes what can or can't be done in the mission field that's closest to us. Now, the other mission field I talked about, you know, these burgeoning churches, they don't even know how you spell seminary. They don't know, they're not influenced by what seminaries will or won't do in this country. But in any event, gradually the residential schools of the world, and there are about 4,000 now, realized that they weren't doing what was kosher. So when Bob Freeman told me, he says, you know, he had to accept this second best, he couldn't get to the field, so I said, listen, what you're doing is more important than what any missionary in the world is doing, because you're helping a prestigious seminary to establish a pattern which will then buttress what ought to continue to happen overseas. And then, of course, the degree completion movement came into being. Again, it's not a movement that was the result of people getting down on their knees and praying, now, Lord, are we really serving the church? It was a movement that was pressured financially. People had to go off campus, and so many schools were scared to death they were going to go broke, that the accrediting associations didn't say anything. And now I understand from Dr. Osting that the accrediting associations are beginning to take a bead and shoot at these decreed completion programs to make sure they increase the quality and the time and all that up to the norm and so forth. But see, it's very, very crucial what the pattern is in this country as you look back across the world. In fact, we fight not against flesh and blood, we fight against cultural forces, mammoth cultural forces. The degree mania of our time, especially in Asia, the inflation of units, the redefinition of all kinds of things, but probably the worst of all is what I would call institutionalization, which replaces the end with the means. Whenever an institution of any kind becomes so concerned about its own existence. I think of, for example, the welfare workers in Wisconsin. I was reading an article in the Times the other day, said that Wisconsin is making remarkable progress in getting people into jobs and getting them off welfare. Their biggest problem is not the people on welfare, but the people in the welfare offices. Now, translate that into the seminaries. The biggest problem with the seminaries is that they don't want what is needed. Most. Their needs, they can only stay in business, the welfare workers, if there are lots of people on welfare. They don't want people to go off welfare. And they are the biggest single problem in the state of Wisconsin. There are other ways that people can measure progress. I mean, the post office, for instance, there's some link between how much mail comes in and what the people are paid. I know that to be true, because they're eager to get the business away from the other post office down there. It could only be true if there's something in that for them. So the post office measures its success in part by how much the volume is. So all kinds of institutions measure themselves by different things. But when an institution gets to the point where they measure themselves by how many students are there or what their enrollment is, say, that's only a means to the end. The question is, who's there? Or more poignantly, who is it that isn't there? Now, John Wimber, a local boy here, I knew him before he was famous. He never went to seminary to study. He went to seminary to teach. And they've got, what is it, 200, 300, 500 churches? I don't know. Those people don't go to seminary. They should. I'm the first one to say that what seminary has to offer is very, very significant to those people. But somehow the access isn't there. And on, we could say this for many, many leaders in America today. The growing edge of the American church has learned to do without the seminaries. Not because the seminaries don't have something very crucial to offer. Not because they don't know how to offer it even. It's because they don't want to offer it. Now, I'll give you a case in point. The seminaries balked and screamed at the thought of offering a two-year degree. True or false? It's true. That was a tremendous, traumatic thing for them to offer a two-year degree because they didn't want it to cut into their three-year degree. I remember sitting at dinner in the home of a professor at Westminster Seminary. I better not mention any names. And I was praising him for this downtown MA program in missiology in the heart of Philadelphia. I no sooner got halfway into the sentence. He says, yeah, but you can't get an MDiv on that, on the basis of that. You have to start all over. You come back to this campus, you start from scratch if you're going to get an MDiv. See, he was protecting a certain program. He didn't care what happened to those poor folks down in Philadelphia. I don't think. He was really primarily thinking about the means rather than the end. And on you could go and give hundreds of examples of this. So I just leave you with this to think about. There are probably a number of positive things that we could do differently that would enable some insight to come from this topic. But I felt, you know, if all I do is to identify the problem that we're teaching the wrong people, we're not teaching the right people. University of Wisconsin during the Second World War was asked by the Navy to prepare all of their college courses for extension use. And they were going to get paid for it. University of Wisconsin is a very high-level, high-class, respectable school. But they didn't have any trouble doing that. Just like that. Every course in the whole college was now available to anyone in the Navy, anywhere. They just did it like that. But they drove a hard bargain. When the war is over, every single book you still have in your hands will be burned. Because we want to go back to our cloistered, hallowed school. We don't want to benefit like we did. 2.5 million students they had. How do you like that? 2.5 million students. Simply because they were paid to do it. They could do it. There's nothing mysterious about extension. Technology and all that kind of stuff is great, but helping people that are out there is pretty obvious how to do it. You don't have to be a brain. And yet, it's the question of whether we want to do it, not whether we are able to do it. And what we do in this country has overwhelming impact upon schools around the world, and most of the schools around the world are going in the wrong direction. Well, I'll leave that as a basis if there's any further comments or discussion here.
You have an opportunity to make some comments or ask a question of Dr. Winter, and I'm going to repeat the question for the tape, and then he will respond. Yes. In what sense do you view the view of some denominations about the professionalization of the pastorate as a requirement, for instance, with the MDiv, as what kind of effect does that have?
It's like shooting yourself in the foot. Really. I mean, that's the historical fact. Every single denomination in this country that has required formal extensive graduate professional training for ordination is going downhill. There are no exceptions. There are no exceptions in the whole world. Now, the Southern Baptist, which you Ben told us about, is very interesting. He says that the people who are planning churches are the ones that were in the extension program. Don't think that's cause and effect. You know, that's kind of a tricky statistic. What the Southern Baptists have done is they have gone to the people who are planning churches already and tried to train them. So no wonder the people in extension are church planters, because they were church planters before they got in. And now they're better church planters. So it isn't exactly the fault of the seminaries, but it is also true that very few of those church planters have the time or the social configuration to go off for years to seminary, even if it doesn't cost you anything to go to a Southern Baptist seminary.
Ralph, you've identified the problem. What's your prognosis for the future? Are you optimistic or pessimistic?
In this country, it would be a little different from what it would be in the rest of the world. I've already described the fact that most of the growing Christianity of the world doesn't even know what a seminary is. So, in a certain sense, don't worry about Christianity. It can take care of itself. This is the outrageous phenomenon. Most people think that we've got to send more missionaries and send more money and send just to keep Christianity from collapsing. It's almost the other way around. We could double our missionary force, we couldn't even stop it from growing. I'm very optimistic about the church. I don't think there's much hope for these 4,000 schools unless they get with it.
Do you want to comment on the curriculums being designed around the Great Commission as well as the Great Commitment?
Since the average evangelical seminary is mainly talking about the Old Testament or the New Testament or church history at any given time. I mean, that's their core emphasis. It's not very hard for that material to be interpreted in terms of global mission. This is what we've done in our 320 lessons that run all the way through seminary. And we've been overjoyed to discover, you know, right in the book of Genesis, missiological events. Normally, you know, people study Genesis in one school and missiology in another school, and when they study Genesis, they don't study the missionary events of that narrative. When they study missiology, they don't study Genesis. The two things are separated out. But there are 35 missiological issues in the book of Genesis. And so it's perfectly possible to integrate all this. I don't think it's very difficult, but it is very unlikely, for the simple reason that those that handle the Bible don't normally think in terms of global mission. And I would just say also that in terms of the optimism or the pessimism, it's sort of like the New Testament situation where the Jews could be pessimistic about the expansion of their faith, and they wouldn't recognize the Greeks as being the same faith. So they were pessimistic when they could have been optimistic. Later on, the Catholics were very pessimistic when they saw the breakaway of what was later called Protestantism. They were pessimistic when they should have been optimistic. We're in a similar situation here today, where we're looking across the world and we say, what? What's going on? And some people are very pessimistic about the heresies and the abounding diversities and the confusion of the global Christian movement, when maybe they should be very optimistic. So it's partly a question of what you're looking at, from what perspective.
Would you like to comment on the comment that overseas, particularly, the possible theological vacuum is being filled by particularly the Bible college movement and extensions of that movement?
I wish it were true. It is true that there are 4,000 schools. We have a book produced by the World Evangelical Fellowship, the Theological Commission, listing 4,000 schools, including quite a few Western schools, of course, as well. And at least 3,000 of these would be in the non-Western world. And they have got students. You can figure out how many students they've got. But it's still only a drop in the bucket. Not only that, and I certainly want to say here, I'm not just saying that theological education overseas is valid and useful and you can count it only if it's like what we do in this country. What we do in this country just won't fit in most situations overseas. I have no problem at all with these scurrilous Bible schools. In fact, I feel a little bit funny that this association has sort of accidentally demoted a lot of schools because they didn't fit a certain monocultural pattern. It's like saying the Constitution of the United States says, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of education or the restricting of the free enterprise thereof. Well, we've made that law. We say you can't be an institutional member of this association unless you do certain things a certain way, which for the most part have very little relevance to the non-Western world. So in that momentary, I would think, erroneous conclusion, our association did kind of wound itself in terms of recognizing the validity of Bible training of many other sorts. But take all that into account. The ordaining force in most mission-related churches, which is a very substantial part of what we would call recognizable Christianity around the world, the ordaining requirements are such as to rule out people for ordination if they only have scurrilous training. I use the word scurrilous, playfully, what some people consider scurrilous. There's always going to be one person who went off to Columbia Bible College and came back with a proper degree, and from then on, all other education is not worthy. The student volunteer movement sent people into Africa. Kepha Sempongi, in his book, A Distant Grief, observed how these new missionaries coming out with college degrees, these were the first missionaries with college degrees, and they saw African pastors. Can you believe pastors, ordained ministers who didn't have a college degree? And they pushed him out of the pulpit. It took 40 years for them to recover a missiology that would understand the need for shifting gears. See? Even after you shift all the gears, take all the books and training and schools and so forth, probably the most remarkable use of Bible schools that I know of would be in Latin America by the Assemblies of God in their so-called night Bible schools. These night Bible schools, first of all, were in the evening. That means they were accessible. As far as I'm concerned, a night school is an extension operation. Distance, frankly, has nothing to do. Remember the CPA who lived next door to the seminary. Distance education would have solved his problem, but the distance was not geographical. In any case, those night Bible schools fueled an amazing amount of biblical knowledge and stature in the Word that enabled then the people who'd gone through those Bible schools to be elevated into the ministry over a long process, which was very careful in selection and so forth, so that in the so-called Pentecostal movement, very rarely is a man ordained who's the wrong man. In our movement, once the A school, whatever you call it, gets a hammerlock on who gets ordained, and the church, someone else asked earlier, the church says, okay, we won't ordain anybody unless they go to your school or to that kind of a school. Once they make that fatal step, they've ruled out most of the gifted people who could be leaders in the church. And that's what the Assemblies of God did not do. And their movement, you might as well be a Pentecostal if you're going to go to Latin America. Talk about pessimism, optimism. The mainstream churches that we think of as respectable churches in this country, they're not only half dead in this country, they're practically dead completely. No, I wouldn't say they're dead, they're just outnumbered. They're zany, rare objects by comparison to the mainstream, the new mainstream of Latin America, and the same would be true in slightly different form in most other parts of the world.
Okay, I'm afraid time has left us. Dr. Wintrud, thank you once again for a very provocative discussion. And Larry McCullough would like to make an announcement.
In March 97, our executive committee began to discuss about the possibility of periodically making a presentation of a Lifetime Achievement Award for someone who has dramatically impacted distance learning throughout the world. And it didn't take much discussion or much deliberation to come up with our first choice. That person that we'd like to make our first presentation to is Dr. Ralph Winter. Now, I'll ask you to hold your applause for just a moment, and in a second, Ralph, I'll signal you to please come up. Let me hasten to say that should any of you choose to volunteer to host an access meeting on your campus or your home site, it doesn't mean you're going to get one of these things. And we're not sure that it's going to be every year. But Ralph, I would like for you to come now, please. We're delighted that the staff of the U.S. Center and William Carey University are here tonight to be a part of not only this presentation, this meeting, but this award as well. And I want you to know personally that many of us have been praying for your wife, Roberta, and her health situation over the last 12 to 14 months. Sorry she could not be with us this evening. Let me read for you what the plaque says. Access proudly presents this Lifetime Achievement Award to Ralph Winter for invaluable contributions to the field of distance learning, January 1998.
Well, I hope there will be many others similarly honored in the future, because obviously it takes a lot of different people to turn a big ship around. Someone said that it takes, to turn the Queen Mary around, it takes 25 miles compared to a tugboat, which can turn in 25 feet. And it takes a lot of different people pushing intelligently, faithfully, patiently across the years. You know, Jim Emery was out there 5 years before I was. When I got to Guatemala, it was in 1957. He was there in probably 1952. He and I have been working all these years as best we can at every touch point where you could do anything that would be helpful. But if it weren't for the Second World War and the baby boom and the degree completion movement and other things completely outside of our control, we wouldn't have even seen what is today a remarkable and perhaps only a temporary window of opportunity. I warn you that what created the degree completion movement and thus brought into credibility off-campus training more massively than any other single event in American history, the babies of the boomers are coming. They're in the school system already. There's going to be another boom, not as big a boom, but the babies of the boomers will be swelling the ranks of the colleges, and many schools will say, look, we don't need to do all this off-campus nonsense anymore. And there may come a time when access will shrink back to what it was for so many years, a bunch of what often were called scurrilous schools just out there helping people with a Bible who were not given any credence. It's only been in the last few years that these major institutions and Christian colleges and seminaries have come into access. And I guess this is a little bit of a warning. Don't let these people tyrannize this organization. We're out to give access to the Word to people wherever they are, by whatever method. And if we hold ourselves to a certain pattern that only works in America, in fact, doesn't even work in America, we are in big, big trouble. So thanks very much for this.
This concludes this program.